Thank you. Thank you, Scooby. Yeah, I'm Jimmy Egan, alcoholic. And originally from New York. I used to come down here and visit, and they used to call me Yankee. Last February, I moved down permanently, and now I'm a damn Yankee. But I'm not going back. I'm not going back. I came down here saying I love all you guys. I really did. Now I'm learning how to say I love y'all. That's the difference. Other than that, it's no different. The people are beautiful. They're very warm, and the program is just outstanding wherever I go, and I really love it. In fact, I had occasion to speak at an AA function. I think it was Wednesday, and before a group, and Dina was there, and it's the first time I'd ever seen her. And I never mentioned alcoholic or alcoholism or powerless over alcohol. But she was in security, and she was showing me to my car after. And we got outside, and she said to me, "Are you a friend of Bill Wilson's?" And I wanted to tell her, yeah, for the last 15 years. Well, it'll be 15 years in February. But we talked a minute, and she told me that that day was her third anniversary of not having a drink a day at a time, and I thought that was great. She asked me then if I would speak here tonight, which was only several days later. Well, she had a blue uniform on and a mean look, and she exuded that confidence that Scooby said she had, and I said, sure, I will. I would have anyway. I'm an Irish fellow. And it often makes me wonder about the Irish nationality and the Irish culture. It seems years and years ago they left Ireland because of the potato famine and moved to this country. Men and husbands were packing up their wives and children, whatever, and leaving their nation to go to another nation simply because they ran out of potatoes. You know, but we did retain the culture over here. In fact, we see it very often at an Irish seven-course meal, which consists of a boiled potato and a six-pack. But today I eat the boiled potatoes, but I pass on the six-pack. You know, listen to Norman when he was reading, and he mentioned about we can't keep it unless we give it away. And that is such a powerful message in this program and in any area of life. And I often feel that when I speak at a meeting or when I go to a meeting and just hear others speak, and I know that it is my God speaking through me or speaking through you to me. But I also know that anything I learn in this program, anything I hear and add to my life and practice it out there to give me a better life and to strengthen my sobriety, I just feel obligated to pass it on. Someone once said to me, "Jimmy, I'm so grateful for my sobriety." He says, I would love to pay it back. I says, "How do I pay back what I've got?" And I says, "Well, my friend, in this program, we don't pay back. What we do is just pass it on to the next fellow, pass it on to as many as you possibly can." But you know, if I didn't pass it on, let's say that I hear something that's really good for me and good for my sobriety, and I keep it inside and I never let it out, and I never let it out. I never pass it on to someone else. It would be as if I took a cup of cold running water, cool, clear drinking water, and I set it down, and I looked at that cup of drinking water, and as cool and fresh and exciting as it might be, I let it stand for a day, and then 2 days, and then 5 days, and then a week, and then maybe 2 weeks. Well, that nice, cool, fresh water in that cup, sooner or later, would start to become stagnant. And anything I learn in this program, anything that my God has passed on to me, if I keep it inside and never let it out, never pass it on to someone else, sooner or later it will become stagnant within me. Sooner or later it will become stagnant within me, and I would become stagnant. And I also found that a stagnant mind in this life becomes a resentful mind. A stagnant mind becomes a resentful mind. By a stagnant mind, I mean there are many of us who are very exceptional in our work and are always learning and doing better, which is good. There are many who know all about professional sports or athletes, and they keep learning more and more and adding to that, and that is good. But a lot of times, these same people are very unhappy people in life, and that is simply because they haven't grown spiritually. The only true happiness, the only true joy comes from the inside, and is the happiness, it is the joy that's offered to me through this program, through the spiritual concept of this program. And it makes me feel real good. Every time I go to a meeting, I know that on a Monday, I can hear one good thing. No matter how I feel inside, even if I feel real good, I can hear one good thing and add it to my life and make me feel that much better. And you know, I can take that one thing into Tuesday and hear something else. Now I've got two good things. And add that to my life and take those two good things into a Wednesday. And now I hear something else, I've got three good things. And this goes on. By the time the weekend comes up, I'm dynamite, and I've got the rest of my life ahead of me. And that's why I keep coming to meetings. I'm 14 years in this program, and I try to make a meeting each and every day of my life. Sometimes I can't, but usually I do. And each time I go to a meeting, I know I'm going to hear one good thing. My God allows that. And I know I'm going to add it to my life, and I know I'm going to practice it when I get out there. And I know as good as I feel today, I'm going to feel a whole lot better when I leave this room. And this is my program for me. This is why meetings are not only important for me, they're just so enjoyable. I know many people that after a period of sobriety seem to fade from meetings. And it isn't the fact that they want to drink again. It's the fact that for somehow this mind of theirs just doesn't seem to be grasping the excitement of these new spiritual awarenesses that I'm receiving anyway. And so this is so important to me. I think what I hear at meetings is not only more important, but more exciting to my inner than if you put a $50 bill in my pocket. Because sooner or later, I'm going to spend that 50. But if I keep that spiritual awareness, I know that I'm going to feel better internally on a continual basis. And you know, that's in a sense what I like to talk on maybe tonight. Dean Martin, the infamous singer and well-known drinker, whether it's true or not, at least that was his M.O., he once said that, "I feel sorry for those people that don't drink. When they wake up in the morning, that's the best they're going to feel all day long." And you know, I know first coming into this program, and for some many times after, that they feel, well, when I wake up, if I don't feel too good, it's still the best I'm going to feel, because all I have now is me. And not realizing that the greatest thing that we can possibly have in this life is me. The greatest excitement we can have in life is the me that's inside us, that's already inside us. And this program teaches me how to release that person, how to release all those good feelings and all those good emotions that make my life exciting on a daily basis. This is what's really important to me. I'm very grateful to be asked to come here tonight and speak. I really am. You know, gratitude is such an important part of my program. I know today, if I'm not grateful for what I have, I don't deserve anything more. If I'm not grateful for what I have right now, I certainly don't deserve anything more. If I'm not grateful for what I have today, I doubt if I'll keep what I have right now. Because, you know, every gain I make in this program, it seems that I grow and gain in certain plateaus. But each plateau must be supported with gratitude. Everything I hear at these meetings and add to my life, unless I'm grateful for it, I'm not going to keep it. I'm not going to be able to keep it, because to me it is meaningless. That's for someone that lacks the gratitude, and I, please believe me, have an overabundance of gratitude in my program. I don't have to think of what I'm grateful for. I just know the fact that I'm not drinking on a daily basis, and I have a program today that I can come to help me arrest the disease of alcoholism. It's so important for me. I know when I first came to this program and I heard about that first step, I used to think maybe I was alcoholic before I came in this program. I wasn't sure. So what I thought I would do was try and cut down on my drinking. And I began to realize that I couldn't do that. If I had one drink, I had a compulsion for a second. When I had that second, I had a stronger urge or compulsion for a third. And when I had that third, I was into oblivion. I come to realize today, after learning about being powerless over alcohol, that I cannot take one drink safely. I cannot take one drink safely. And you know, I remember that I tried to quit for a while before I came in this program and maybe straighten out my life. And, you know, I never did last too long, sometimes several days. One day, one time, maybe 4 or 5 days. And then I figured, well, I haven't had a drink in quite a while. Maybe I'll go out and have a few tonight. I'm not going to get bombed. I'm just going to have a few. But the alcoholism inside my system wouldn't allow that. See, I didn't understand the powerlessness of it. I thought even if I was alcoholic, I would only have one or two. And I've had many people say that to me, Jimmy. Why don't you just have one? You haven't drank in so long, maybe you can have just one. I cannot safely have one drink. If I have one drink, I'm drinking again. That's the way it looks to me, because that one drink is going to give me the urge of the compulsion for a second. So today, thanks to my God, you people in this program, I no longer drink a day at a time. And it was quite a while. I never drank until I was maybe in my late teens. I had won the Golden Gloves in New York, and I won the light heavyweight title up there. And then I campaigned. I boxed the fellow that won the heavyweight title several times, and I campaigned in central and northern New York, parts of Canada and Pennsylvania. And I was off to a pretty good start. I was still in high school. And, you know, for some reason, I didn't like high school. And for some reason, I didn't want to go to work. Today, I don't really know what those reasons were. Maybe it was just the fact that I had lack of incentive or desire for either one. And I knew that I had a nice career ahead of me, maybe as an athlete, if this is what I wanted to do. And I thought that this was what I wanted to do. And I used to go out sometimes and with a bunch of guys, and they'd all have their beers, and I'd have a Pepsi or a Coke or something. And I remember one night that I ordered myself a beer. I just thought I'd see what it was like. I never identified drinking with like being macho or drinking with an escape. I never identified it with anything. I was just kind of curious as to what these guys were getting out of this. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to be the all-American boy. So let me tell you about alcoholism and the compulsion. I had one drink that night, one glass of beer. And wow, I wanted another one. I had two. I think I had seven. And I can't remember just what happened, but the next morning I had to do my road work. And when I got up, I felt so fast and light and speedy. I felt like a gazelle. I think that's the fastest animal. I says, boy, I'm going to incorporate this in my training. And you know, I did. Unbeknown to me, I did. Not because I wanted to, as I thought, but because I had to. And, you know, then things began to happen. I was young, and I was aggressive, and I was conditioned, and I had a lot of stamina and endurance. And the alcohol didn't take over right away, but it did start dictating me as to a lot of things that I was going to do that I didn't think I should, and a lot of things that I did do that I didn't want to. And one was I started abstaining from the gymnasium a little bit. I started missing road work a little bit. Then I started feeling sometimes logy or tired. My timing would be off, as you might say. And then I had a great experience. It was right after I turned professional up there. And they mashed me with quite a comer. And you know, the experience was, I call it the second lousiest feeling in my life. The first is the headaches and heartaches and hangovers of waking up after a drunk. The second was losing to someone that I knew I could beat. I knew I could beat this fellow, but I didn't that night because of the drink. I didn't understand what it was. I thought it's because I had missed the gymnasium a few times. I thought it was because I was hanging around the street corners too late or I wasn't eating right. That disease of denial, I never identified the booze with it, but that was really what took that wind from me. I didn't understand that too well. But you know, also along that time in the gymnasiums in them days, we had an element that hung around there. They used to call it the underworld. And they thought I could be quite an asset to them. I was 6'2", weighed a couple hundred pounds. I was some kind of a boxing champion. And you know, they thought maybe I could help them in a certain area of their business, like collecting unpaid bills or debts, as you might call them. And, you know, the promoters were backing off from me a little. They thought that I might have a problem. I remember they mashed me with another comer up there, and this time I really could have got myself in the limelight if I had beaten this guy. And there was quite a promotion on this fight, and we went to sign for the fight. The promoter at the time had a bar and a restaurant, and that's where the fight crowd hung out. And I went to meet him down there, and the photographers were there, and the fight crowd was there. And he called me aside, and he says, Jimmy, I got to ask you to do me a favor. And I says, what's that? And he says, I want you to post what they call an appearance bond for this fight. And I says, an appearance bond? What are you talking about? That I'll show up? And he says, yeah. I says, well, you know, I took that as an insult. I says, I can beat this bum. What do you think? I'm not going to show up. And he said to me, I was a young man at the time, he says, Jimmy, I want to tell you something. Myself and quite a few others in this town have got a lot of faith in you, but I, for one, know that there's too many saloons between your house and the War Memorial where we were going to fight. I slipped that like I slipped a punch. I didn't understand what he said. I knew I was drinking, but I didn't think that was a real problem. I posted the bond, and when the fight night came, I appeared. And I lost again to someone that I really felt that I could beat. And, you know, now I began to listening to this other element, this underworld element. And I went to work for those fellows because the fight promoters were kind of backing off a little bit. And this is when I first learned a lesson that didn't become aware to me till after I'd come in this program. As you think, as you are. Whatever we do in life, however we think, we're going to get a result of it. Right now, please believe me, if I think ill or wrong of anyone in this room, anyone at all, sooner or later, and it may not be that same person, someone's going to think ill or wrong of me. That's the law of thought. Whatever I give out in thought will not return void. That's the perfect justice in this world. You know, if I think good, good things are going to happen eventually. If I think poor, poor things are going to happen. If I think good of somebody in this room right now, it may not be that same person, but sooner or later somebody's going to think good of me. I cannot overcome that law any more than I can overcome the law of gravity. If I had something heavy in my hand and let it go, everyone in this room would know, unconsciously know, that it's going to hit the ground. Nobody would try to prevent it, the law of gravity. It can't be done. Nobody would try to overcome it. Neither can I overcome this law of being, which the law of thought in the spiritual part of this program teaches me that. So anyway, I began working with this other element, this underworld element, and I began to reap the rewards of that kind of life. I got sentenced to 2 1-years in the county penitentiary. And I used to think at that time it was a tough break, not knowing that this was what was supposed to happen. And when I came out of the penitentiary, I was still young. When I thought I'd go back in the gymnasiums, I still had a lot of opportunity, and I had a world of talent. Everyone knew that. But, you know, I also went into the bar rooms. I also went into the saloons, not knowing the difference, and I was getting the same results, winning a few and losing a few. And this really wasn't working out for me. I began once again. I like to spend money and to go on the Great White Way, whether it be in a little town or a big town or wherever. And once again, I was back with that underworld element. And in 1957, I was... charged with what they call safe cracking. That's when you take money out of a safe that don't belong to you. And worse than that is it was right across the highway from the state police barracks, and they really frowned upon that. I was fortunate, as I thought, I got 5 years probation. But about 2 years later, in Rochester, New York, I was charged with trying to relieve a jewelry store of its valuables. Once again, I got what I thought was a break. This time I got 1 year's violation of probation. They couldn't indict me for the jewelry store. And I did a year in the county pen and nullified the rest of the probation that I owed. I thought I'd come out better than I went in. I really did. And, you know, I came back to Syracuse. It was a hot day in September, and I was very thirsty. I went in this saloon. I was going to have a cold bottle of beer. I thought it would take maybe 8 or 10 bottles or a case to get me drunk because I hadn't had a drink in over 8 months. But, you know, I had one beer, and before it was half gone, I had that familiar buzz on. I was high again. And that's the progression of alcohol that was working in my system. Every night after night after night after night after night, I laid up in that jail cell. That progression was going on inside me, but I didn't understand it. And so now I was back out. I boxed the last time in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which used to be a great fight town before the coal mines closed up. And once again, they gave me an opportunity to get back on top. They matched me with another a pretty good fellow. They took me to Rochester, New York, which was 80 miles from Syracuse, and got me in tremendously good condition. We went up to Scranton about 3 days before the fight, and I was in a hotel room, and one of the fellows in the group with us the night before the fight came up to my room, and he says, Jimmy, he says, you'll never guess. You never believe what we ran into. And I says, what's that? And he says, there's a saloon about 2 blocks down. The guy's got the same name as yours, Jimmy Egan. And he says, we told him we were fighting tomorrow night, and he'd like to meet you and talk about it. He's a great fight fan. So I says, yeah, let's go down and see this guy. So I went down. I remember having a 7-Up, and maybe I had another one. I don't know. Then I remember there was a beer glass or two in front of me, and then a shot glass. And I remember the next night they had about poured me into that ring. And whether I won or lost makes no difference. All I know is on the way back to Syracuse, on the way back home, I had made up my mind that boxing is like a religion. You know, many times I've seen talent be overcome by got condition and determination, and we'll see that in many areas of life. Talent is useless unless it's prepared. And so I began to realize that I somehow, the desire I had to become a fine athlete slowly slipped away to another desire I had, and that was to drink and just hang around. And I couldn't believe it, but this is what I gave in to. So I never went back in the gymnasiums. What I did is I went back into that other life. And you know, a funny thing happened. In 1961, a girl let me realize that I was good enough to marry her, and I did. And we left Syracuse on our honeymoon that night to go to Baltimore, Maryland, not because of the honeymoon, but because I heard a grand jury was sitting on some flim-flam charges I was supposed to be involved in. Flim-flam is confidence scores or swindling or whatever. And we got out of town, and I don't know how many other people in this room outside of me have been extradited on their honeymoon, but I was. And believe me, it doesn't make for a very good marriage. I went to trial on the swindle charges and once again felt I was fortunate. I was acquitted. And you know, this is like what we used to call the bum on the street corner, looking for a handout. And you think you're doing the guy a favor by giving him a dollar, when in actuality what we're doing is helping him stay out there another day on the street. It's like giving the alcoholic another drink, thinking you're helping this fellow, and what we're doing is only getting him deeper and deeper into the waste of life. And this is what these court decisions were doing for me. We had top criminal lawyers then. I was with a real outfit, and I was getting acquitted, and I was going back out there feeling that now I'm untouchable, that I can do this, I can do that, I can do about anything and get away with it. Well, 1964 told me a story. And in 1964, all this is on record. I couldn't deny this if I wanted to. In 1964, I got indicted in Chautauqua County on 9 counts of forgery. The state's attorney came in on this one, and he says, look, this guy isn't writing checks, and he isn't passing them, but he's heading a statewide forgery ring, and we got to put a stop to this. Well, I went out on bail in Chautauqua County, and I went back in Onondaga County in 1964, the same year, and I got indicted this time on 54 counts of forgery. And out on bail and back into the saloons, probably. And I got indicted again in 1964 on accessory to robbery one. And I went back out on bail and back into the saloons, and I got indicted again in 1964 on robbery in the first degree. And this time the bonding companies began to feel that I was becoming a risk, and they kind of backed off. And they lodged me in this new public safety building jail up there. Well, the summer of 1964, I got indicted by the federal government. This time on a $450,000 postal money order scheme with the infamous Utica mob up there. And now I was pretty in deep. And I had a lawyer that was quite a prominent criminal lawyer up there, and he came to me and he says, you know, Jimmy, maybe we can get you out of here if we can consolidate all these bails into one. The senior court judge that's handling your case is going on vacation, and this guy that's sitting in, I'm going to go talk to him and see what we can do. And I says, fine. Well, my lawyer come back in about 4 or 5 days, and I met him in the consultation booth there, and he was shaking his head, and he said to me, Jimmy, what the hell did you do in this town? And I says, what are you talking about? And he says, that judge I went to see about consolidating the bills. And I says, yeah. He says, he's one of the guys you swindled. So I sent for a toothbrush. I knew I was going to be there for a while. In between, unbeknown to me, you know, I was a pretty good guy. I loved people. I used to for ice cream, and I used to buy groceries for some people now and then. Of course, you know, it wasn't always my money I was using, but I thought I was doing a good deed. And I remember the poor widow, God bless her. She lived just outside of the town in this little shack, and she had a mean, angry landlord, a real Scrooge. And we used to stop and see her now and then, and she'd always have a little pot of soup on her, a little pot of stew, and she'd always feed us something. And she knew we were hoods. She didn't care. We were nice to her. And we'd always bring her a little bag of groceries or something. But this one night, she was very upset and very worried. And we said, why? And she says, well, this fellow, this landlord, was going to have her evicted. He was going to throw everything out on the street corner on a Tuesday, and that's it, because she didn't pay the rent. And this is before the new tenant-landlord agreements, when landlords could do that. And so I asked her, I says, one of the guys knew this guy. And he says, Jimmy, he's a real screwball. Boy, all he loves to do is evict people, and he'll throw this poor old lady out in the street. And I says, how much is your rent? And she told me, and I gave it to her. And I says, let me do this one favor. I says, you contact your landlord, and you tell him to come here on a certain night at a certain time, and you'll have the money for him. And she did that. You know, she was so grateful that she had her rent. Well, he came, she paid him his rent, and he left. About a half hour later, he got robbed. And you know, let me tell you something. I couldn't understand the philosophy of life. I thought I did a good thing. I helped a woman pay her rent. I helped a landlord get his rent. And I got my investment back. But not everybody looks at life like that. But that's the way I did at that time. And this reminds me of that return us to sanity, that second step. Not that we're always insane. I don't think it really indicates that. It's just insane, not thinking right. Well, anyway, this was the good things that I thought I was doing in life. When I was in that county jail, after waiting for trial, I was helping guys write letters that couldn't express themselves, maybe to their wives or children or to their lawyer or something, buying cigarettes for some guys that didn't have any, and just an all-around good guy. I liked people. I had 4 indictments from the state and 1 from the U.S. government, and I still had a pretty good attitude. And I didn't understand this, that because in a sense I was helping people now in sort of a legitimate way, that my life was changing unbeknown to me. And I went to trial on the robbery charge. They tried me on that first. I had the safe conviction, and please believe me, don't get in no trouble in New York State, because if convicted on this robbery charge, the maximum would have been 60 years. And we went to trial, and when the jury come back, you know, juries are very funny. I can read their faces and tell you what they're going to say. I can watch Judge Wapner now, and I can really, before he gives a decision, I'm pretty sure I know what it's going to be. And when the men come out and they look at the ceiling or look at the floor and will not look at the defendant, and the women come out and they're dabbing their eyes with a handkerchief, and your lawyer leans over and says, "We're dead." And I thought of the 60 years and the fact that my lawyer wasn't going to be up there with me, nor was anybody else. I leaned back and said to him, "What do you mean we, Frank?" And sure enough, they found me guilty. Well, we challenged all the indictments. We challenged the constitutionality of whatever, and we put off sentencing for quite a while. And in the meantime, in the county jail, I continued to be a pretty good guy. And when I went up for sentencing, it really, in a sense, proved itself. Because instead of giving me 60 years, that judge only gave me 40. And boy, I felt pretty good about that. And it was right after the blizzard of 66 or 67 up in New York, and they sentenced me to Attica State Prison, where that infamous riot was, where everyone got killed. 13 or 29 people got killed, including correction officers and inmates. And, you know, they took me up there, and I was supposed to be involved with organized crime, and I was supposed to be a real bad dude. And they exemplified this by putting me in leg irons, and they had a wide belt around my waist with a cuff on each side. And as they drove me up through the road that they cut through the snowbanks, there was police cars in front of us and state police cars behind us. And when they got me up in front of Attica State Prison and let me out of the car, it was still early in the morning. And you know, that sky was dim and grim and cold and bleak and gray and damp. And it looked like it was just ready to belly out with some kind of precipitation. And I looked at that 40-foot wall that was also gray and grim and dark with ice and snow trickling down the side. And I looked at those correction officers in the turrets with their riot guns and tear gas guns. I looked at the state police and the sheriffs that had brought me up with a correction officer and had their riot guns with them. And I looked at the prison itself and I says, "Well, Jimmy, here you are. Here's home for the next 40 years or for however long they want to keep you." In the New York State law, they really wouldn't keep you for 40, but it's written so that they could, if a sense they didn't see something different in that person that went in. And you know, I went in there. And I went in there determined that I wasn't going to do hard time. Hard time to me is mostly caused by those who sit in there and think about the outside. You know, we all have loved ones, whether it's a wife or if a case of a female, husband or children. We think of things that we could or should be doing. Holidays come and you can't help your family in any way. These are the things that cause some to crack up. And I wouldn't allow myself to do that. I wouldn't think it to where it started to bother me. I would just reminisce a little and pass it on. And you know, they called me into the service unit up there. And never once through all this did I ever think that alcohol was anything to do with this. I never did. You know, in the underworld, as you might say, any time we went away, what we used to call it is occupational hazard. Something went wrong. And I used to blame the judges, the stool pigeons, the prosecutors, the tainted evidence, but never Jimmy. Never. It was always somebody else's fault that I was there. Never once did I look at the fact that maybe chasing that battle, looking for happiness or looking for a new and better life was ever going to come from that battle. I never even thought that the drink had anything to do with it. And they called me into this service unit, and this fellow says to me, you know, Jimmy, he says, it looks to me like you're going to be with us for quite a while. And I says, what's quite a while? You know, I got sentenced in 1964. That's when my time began. And he says, you're going to be with us until August of 2004. And I said, what? And he says, August 2004. And I says, oh, I thought you said September. And, you know, this was the attitude that I had taken. I wasn't going to do hard time. I transferred down to Auburn Prison, which was only 25 miles from Syracuse, and I began to change my life. You know, it wasn't the 40-foot wall. It wasn't the cell. It wasn't the bars. It wasn't the confinement. Something was wrong with me because I could do time. I didn't want to, but as long as I had to be there, I could. But, you know, something came over to me. I began to realize, what am I doing to myself? And I needed to change myself. I owed myself a better life than this. I started reading good books, books about people who had made it in life, not necessarily millionaires or presidents of corporations, just people who lived a nice life and maybe had changed their life. And I noticed in all the things that I read that they had some kind of a spiritual outlook or a spiritual change that helped them. And, you know, I had one happen to me right in prison, and I began to realize that maybe there is something to this. We had Auburn Insurrection, which is short for riot, and I remember at the time they were building a new building inside the prison walls, and the construction workers had all kinds of material there, and including bulldozers and whatever, and the ironwork was up, the framework was up, and you know, when the insurrection come down, or the riot, and those that were involved in it captured quite a few of the correction officers, and it was a cold, bleak day in November, and everyone was out in the yard, and they took these officers and they sat them down in a big circle in the yard, and they went to this construction site. People, what makes the alcoholic seem to resist so strongly a healing from a disease that's so deadly? And that's it, the word, resisting it. You see, change is very simple. Change is very easy. For me, change in this program is spiritual change. The only thing permanent is spiritual. The only thing permanent is spiritual. And if it's spiritual, it's of God. And if it's of God, it's blissful. And if it's of God, it's instant. If it's blissful, that means it's easy. And if it's instant, there's no problem to get it. It's the resistance that I offer to it that makes it hard. It's the resistance that I offer to it that makes it difficult. If I don't resist, I have a tremendous day on a daily basis. Just like I said before, hear one thing Monday, two things Tuesday, I got three things Wednesday, four things Friday. It's nothing but a program of growth. And each time I hear one good spiritual thing and add it to my life, I feel a little bit better, just a little bit better. I don't care how bad a person feels on Monday, they can be dynamite by Friday with this simple little solution. So this was it. I started to hear these things. And one of them I heard was that this program asked us for spiritual progress. It says nothing about human progress, spiritual progress. Hey, maybe that's it. I remember those books I had read about the spirituality these people attained. Let me try this. Let me see what it can be. See, I remember, you know, there was these two fellows that they didn't like all the congestion of city life. They didn't like politics. They didn't like a lot of things. And they had this cabin way up in the mountains. It was beautiful up there. The air was pure. They would hunt and fish and just lived off nature. It was great. They had a little porch and two rocking chairs, and they'd sit out there and watch the sun go down. Well, you know, at one time, these city folk, they found a big bay of water up there that was also pure. And it was good drinking water, and it was healthy. And so then they started to make a little resort area up there. They called it a spa. And then they started building Burger Kings and McDonald's and hotels and motels. And then they cut a road in the mountain across from them. They could see them cut the road in. And then at the beginning of the season, you know, to go up to the spa, they would see them coming around the mountainside. They'd come with their campers and their trailers and their pickup trucks and their bedrolls and their blankets and their mattresses and their pots and their pans and their cigars and their cigarettes and their husbands howling at wives and wives howling at children and the flat tires and the steaming engines. And one would look at the other and he says, well, here they all come, trying to get away from it all by bringing it all with them. And, you know, that's what I did when I first came in this program. I heard that statement, sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I really was. I wanted to get away from it all. But all I had done was stop drinking. I had it all with me. I was an emotional case. I was dynamite inside, ready to explode. So I started investigating the spiritual aspect of this program and began to realize two greatest secrets of life, two of the great secrets of life. One is resist not evil. Do not resist it in thought. Do not resist it in thought. If a person has harmed me several weeks ago, every time I think about it in torment, every time I think about it in revenge, every time I think about it in anger, he's doing it to me again. He's doing it to me again with my own permission. He's doing it to me again in thought through my own permission. And the more I think about it, the worse I feel. The more I think about it, the bigger it gets. It's getting bigger and bigger in my mind because I'm feeding it the nourishment it needs, the nourishment of thought. And if I don't like the way I feel about it, why don't I just starve it to death? How do I starve it to death? Absent of thought. Don't think about it. Don't even think about it. Wish that person well, but with somebody else. And that's God's law, not my law. Resist not leaving. And the other great secret of success for me, the grand success of living every day out there, is just simply this, right reaction, right reaction. It's how I react to everything that happens to me in the course of a day. The same things happened to me today, 14 years after putting down a drink, has happened to me when I was up in Attica in Auburn State Prison, only maybe under different titles. But the same negative things are out there every day. First, what I did was take the value off it. I have no value in it anymore. If I go out there now, my tire's flat, I used to kick them tires and kick them, no air would go in them, and I'd have to change it anyway. Angry, mean, disgusted, drive away and probably forget the jack, have to go back and get it. Really, if I go out there now, first I know I got to change the tire. But the first thing I do is thank God for the many times I went out there and it wasn't flat. Did you ever think of that? The one time in the year, 365 days, that a person goes out and the car don't start, and they start kicking it and whipping it and beating it, how many times have you gone out there and just turned that switch and started and said, thank God? You see, this is the change in my life. No longer does that flat tire have any negative value, because now what goes on inside me is more important than what goes on outside me. What goes on outside me doesn't have the value that I have inside me. This doesn't mean that I don't meet my obligations the best of my ability. It doesn't mean that I don't try to be the best person I can to the best of my ability. But no longer does anything outside me have any more importance than what goes on inside me. Otherwise, I would be susceptible to whatever goes on in life. My God wouldn't take a baby and set him out in the middle of 285. To fend for himself. That would be cruel and unusual. No longer did he put us in this earth to fend for ourselves against the outer elements. That would have been cruel and unusual. He said we have life in this world and we have dominion over it. And the dominion is through thought. You see, I can't drink again unless first I think about it. I can't drink a cup of coffee unless first I think about picking it up. I couldn't come here tonight until first I thought about it. There ain't anything I can do that first a thought doesn't precipitate the action. Nothing. So, before I drink again, I have to think about it. They asked Dr. Bob, after quite a while of sobriety, if he ever thought he'd drink again. And he says, well, I'll tell you something. If I keep thinking like I'm thinking today and doing the things I'm doing today, I won't drink. He meant on a daily basis. And that's why I keep coming to meetings, because as good as I feel today and as powerful I feel in sobriety, I don't know how I'll feel tomorrow. And if I make a meeting as often as I possibly can, I can not only retain what I have, but increase upon it, build upon it, see. So this is what's important to me. A woman came to me once and she says, Jimmy, I feel real good, I feel great, until my sister and her husband come over. And boy, that sucker just takes all my good feelings. He knows how to get to me. He can really puff me up. And he knows he's doing it and he does it. And I says, well, let me ask you a question. The next time he comes over, suppose he took that $450 console there and started carrying it out and putting it in his car. What would you do then? Oh, she says, I'd tell him to bring it back. And I said, what if he didn't? I'd call the police. I really would. My own brother-in-law, I'd call the police. You see, here's a person that has more value on her TV set than she does on her own good feelings. So this is what's important to me today. What happens inside me, as long as I'm morally and legally right and trying to grow spiritually, is more important than anything. You know, I can say right now that I don't know everybody in this room personally, but I already like everybody in this room. I really do. You know, it's easy to like somebody if you think they like you. There's no challenge. But to like somebody if you think they don't like you, that's not only a challenge, but it's working the spiritual in God's way. It's easy for me to say that I love everyone in this room. And if you love me back, that's great. And I can say I love everybody in this room, but if you don't love me back, that's okay too. Because what I'm really saying is you can add to my life, but you can't take from it. And that's the spiritual fulfillment. That's what it does for us. I have like a pilot light inside me that's warm and glowing. No matter what goes on about me, I'm content with what's inside me. See, I go to meetings and I hear people that have what they call slips. I've never had one. I can't comment on it. I thank my God for that. But generally, I guess we know it's because they chose to drink rather than not. But usually they'll say, well, it was because I was angry at this sucker, or because I got fired or let go from my job, or this happened or that happened. I lost a loved one. And you know, today I understand. So it was the emotion that they used to drink. So if I can keep good emotions inside me, there's a good chance I won't drink again on a daily basis. So in conclusion, I have to tell you about one of the books I read in Auburn Prison. It may not be the greatest book I ever read, but one of the greatest lessons in life that I ever learned. And what it was the story of Michelangelo. Michelangelo, we identify as did the Sistine Chapel, the great painter, and he painted the Last Judgment. But his true love and his true talent was in sculpting. Michelangelo loved to carve out of marble. In fact, he loved it so much, he once said that marble was his mistress. He loved to carve and run his hands over it. He just loved the feeling of it. And this man was a genius, a total genius. His genius was greatly exuded in the Statue of David. And I know someone told me that had seen the actual statue over in Florence, Italy. He said, Jimmy, you can't describe it. He says, you can see photographs of it, you can see replicas of it, but you got to see the actual statue. Because in that statue, he says, it's in marble, and he says, David is standing with a slingshot over his shoulder. He says, he's got tension on one side of his body, and you can see it and feel it and sense it in the marble. That's the genius of this man. You can feel and sense the tenseness in marble on one side, and on the other side of them is relaxation. You can feel the relaxation. You can see it. You can feel it. You can sense it in marble. That's what's made him such a great genius. And when they uncovered that statue in the courtyard over in Italy, and the Pope and all those people that were there, they marveled over it. And someone asked Michelangelo that same day how he carved such a beautiful statue out of that piece of marble. And his response was that he didn't. They said, what? You didn't? And he says, no, I didn't carve that statue out of that piece of marble. He said, that statue was always inside that piece of marble. He said, all I did was chip away and chip away and chip away till I got to it. Then I polished it and refined it. And there's that beautiful statue you're all looking at. And it brings me back to all of us in this room right now. You know, inside each and every one of us are all the wonders in life that we seek. All the wonders in life that we need, all the wonders in life that we're pursuing, they're already inside us. You see, if they weren't, my God wouldn't be a fair God. If happiness was a cloud that floated by and we could reach up and grab a handful of it, it wouldn't be fair. All us tall guys would have the market on happiness. Happiness is inside us. But my God's happiness is not called happiness. It's just a three-letter word, J-O-Y, joy, which supersedes anything that we think in our own minds can make us happy. It's already inside us, like the Prego spaghetti commercial of a year or so back. It's in there. The garlic's in there. Everything's in there. It's already there. Everything we need is already inside us. If anybody in this room tonight, please believe me, is feeling angry, has an angry emotion, understand this. First, it has to come from an angry thought. I cannot feel angry, and first I think angry. Every emotion I have is a direct result of a thought. I can't feel sad unless first I think sad. Every emotion I have is a direct result of thought. I can't feel guilty unless first I think guilty. And you want to know something? I can't feel cheerful unless first I think cheerful. And every thought I have is of my own choosing, whether I know it or not, or whether I like it or not. Every thought I have is of my own choosing. It's how long I want to hang on to a negative thought. If I want to romance it, court it, and take it to bed with me, then I'm going to have to suffer the emotion or the consequences of it. If I want to take a good thought, romance it, court it, and take it to bed with me, then I have to suffer the consequences of a real good feeling. And that's the way it is for me. So in closing, I just want to say that I hope that tonight my God has spoke through me and helped someone a little bit in their sobriety, that they might be able to start enjoying life on a daily basis. Because inside each and every one of us, all we have to do to get to that real person is chip away at those negatives. Chip away, chip away, chip away, till we come to the new and beautiful person that's inside each and every one of us. Thank you.